Okay, well, thank you everyone for coming. There's a lot of you here, so that's really nice. I appreciate that. I will be doing this in English for the benefit of the majority. And my name is Laila Stan, I should mention that. I'm doing my PhD at the Faculty of Health Science, but I'm employed at the Department of Product Design. So this is actually a cross-disciplinary collaborative PhD project between these two disciplines. And I should first acknowledge my bouquet, I like to call it, of supervisors. Because it's a cross-disciplinary project that also involves a lot of different expertise. So I'm very fortunate to have it all represented in this bouquet, everything from health to design. And some of you are here today, so that's really nice. Thank you. A little bit about me and my background, briefly. I have a background both in design, and I also did a master's in health science, or rehabilitation science. Louder, okay. Louder or volume? Okay. I did all my education in Canada up until this point, before I moved to Brussels in Belgium and worked for a few years. Kind of the common denominator here is that I worked a lot with applying new technology, computer-aided design and computer-aided manufacturing methods to health design or health challenges, I should say. That being said, what I learned from a lot of this experience was that these are not solutions to problems in healthcare. There are means, they're not ends. They don't really have any value if they're not part of a system or a service that works for people. So, in some ways, my PhD project will be a bit of a deviation from technology in itself. That was kind of the topping and the heading for today. And perhaps more a suggestion towards how we can develop good solutions for people. And I guess probably the main lesson is that you don't start with the solution. A little overview of some of the things I'll be going through is a little bit about the background, like what is design and health and how do they overlap. A little bit about the methodology, also the context, so actually the clinical setting that I'm actually conducting my research in, and some overview on the project or the work that I've done so far. So the assumption was maybe when I came here, given my background, and also, I think a little bit the assumption today for this presentation was that design and health, the commonality there is technology. But for me, I think, and most designers that I know, and most people that I know that work in health, that's not the focus. The focus is always creating better solutions for people and identifying what needs that are out there that needs to be met. And in some ways, technology is always a given. You know, it's something constant. Health professionals have worked with technology always. Designers use technology always. So rather the focus, I think, is on the people, and that's really the common thread in both design and health. So the project kind of started with this somewhat lofty, kind of far-fetched question of how can we make healthcare better if people were allowed to just design it themselves and create it themselves. And then, of course, it's been reiterated a little bit to where it is today, which is more along the lines of how can we design user-centered health services for people with obstructive sleep apnea. So I'll get back to that a little bit later. Now, doing kind of a cross-disciplinary, multidisciplinary research project is a lot about weaving together knowledge from two different disciplines and kind of walking the line in between. What I really wanted to avoid was doing a design PhD that just happened to be about health or a health PhD that just happened to use a design methodology. So I was kind of trying to walk this tightrope, but at the same time also weaving these disciplines together. It's been a bit of an exercise. It's also an exercise when you're actually trying to relay all that knowledge or information and the research project to such a varied audience that I assume we have here today. But it's been my goal to do that successfully. And one of the ways of doing that, one of the ways I have been doing that is to actually look at some of the parallels between health and design and looking at some of the things that we have in common. But a little bit back to the fundamentals here, because I know there are a lot of designers in the audience, but there's a lot of people who aren't designers and maybe just need that this question answered. And I think in this context, it's most useful to think of design as a process. And this is what we refer to as the design thinking framework, which is kind of the popularized version of a design process that can be applied to research. And in this project, there's a large emphasis on the first part, which is to engage with the stakeholders, users, patients that you are working with. The goal is to really try and understand their needs, but also to understand the context of their world. When you, in reality, kind of looks and feels a bit more like this, design is not a linear process, it's iterative. So you might have cycles of repeated prototyping or even emphasis stages. And especially the more perspectives and people and stakeholders involved at the front end, the fuzzier it gets. So in a co-design process that we will discuss today, it can often be referred to as the fuzzy front end. And it's often recognized by very open-ended questions. And I think one of the challenges in communicating this to health science researchers is that it looks very different than a more traditional linear research project with more defined parameters, maybe a defined research question, and so on. So it's an evolving process. And I'll get back to that again later as well. So I talked a lot about the empathized part, and I talked about the common denominator being the user and identifying user needs and the focus on making things better for people. And one of the things that you'll find discussed a lot in health research that's also very common in design is user involvement. And it's more or less mandated now that in health research you have to have user perspectives represented. Now, what is user involvement? How does it happen? And who is the user? Are a lot of the questions that I've been asking in this process over the past year, I should say. Now, this is actually a diagram that is created more in a design context, but it certainly reflects a lot of the thinking in health science as well when it comes to user involvement, and especially how the thinking is more or less involved from user involvement representing a more, I would say, traditional informative relationship where you as a clinician or researcher informs the participants towards more of a collaborative approach on this end where researcher, clinician, user, patient, participant are more equal. And this is more or less where kind of the design, co-design approach falls. It's really about bringing everyone on board in the research process. And you'll see if you research health science literature and design literature, you see a lot of the same terms and same descriptions applied. Now, when we talk about user-centered design, user-centered healthcare, it's a lot about looking at the problem, the diagnosis, or the issue, whatever it may be, through the eyes of the user or the patient then in a health context, as opposed to kind of looking at it from a more biomedical, traditional point of view. Central to this is experience. Now that kind of leads to another question, who is the user? I mean, I'm sure it's easy to say it's assumed to be the receiver of the service. So the patient maybe, or in a design context, maybe the the buyer. But in a clinical context, it's a bit more complicated than that. Both in design and healthcare, there is writing on this, and who is the user, and also kind of trying to address why do we actually bring users in? Why is this important? In health, of course, we acknowledge that the users or the patients are experts of their own experiences. In design, we often talk about the situated expertise of the user. There's also a lot of discussion on what that actually does to the research process. So a lot of researchers are struggling with what happens and the blurred lines that then happen between the researcher and the user. And they talk about how the traditional researcher kind of has evolved from being a translator to more of a facilitator. So you're not anymore taking someone's expressed needs and translating it into something. You're facilitating that process to happen naturally. This forces the researcher to be a lot more reflexive and reflecting on their own position. And maybe some of that taking for granted power that comes with being a researcher or being a clinician. What has kind of emerged is a more professionalized user representative. So you find that a lot in health research especially. So someone who might be engaged in a patient organization. It could also just be someone who's extra involved, extra vocal, perhaps. We use terms like expert patients, or from Sweden, I've borrowed the spetspatient. Now, in the context of this project, we have, I'll get back to that later, but we have a patient organization that we're reaching out to. But the user is also the patient in the clinic. And all of these perspectives should matter in this process. So how do we negate that and how do we manage that? And I think it's probably been understood from what I've said so far, but why do we involve users? Any suggestions? I think for most of us, it's kind of a given at this point, right? We involve users. It's a natural thing. It's because we care about their perspectives and because we care about their experiences. And said more eloquently, by identifying the key moments and places, moments of truth or touch points where people come into contact with the service and where their subjective experiences are shaped, and therefore where the desired emotional and sensory connections need to be established, and working with the frontline people who bring alive those various touch points in the journey, it is possible to begin designing experiences rather than processes. And this is not actually referring to a clinical setting, but to me it's highly applicable when you're talking about healthcare services. Now, that also leaves the question, so when is the user involved? If you're thinking about a traditional research process or a design process, when do you actually involve user perspectives? Going back to the design thinking framework, I think a typical way designers would approach this is they'll collect user experiences and insights at the beginning. They'll develop a solution, and then they'll usually try and test those solutions up against with the users again in the end, very end. And I think that's probably something that's more or less the traditional way of doing it in traditional research projects as well. You might just have a series of projects to accomplish this. So for this project, it was a bit of a process to figure out, okay, but how can we maintain the user perspective and user involvement throughout this process? And who should those people be? And it's not 100% defined yet, to be sure, but the sketch, I guess, for now, is to have both user representatives as well as those patients in the clinic, more grassroots perspectives involved. So to try and keep the continuity of the user representative or user perspective throughout this process. So that's a little bit about the background and the thinking going into this. And now a little bit to the context, and then we'll get a little bit more concrete. So I'm doing the research project in collaboration with LOL Sykehuset på Gardermoen. LOL is the National Association for Heart and Lung Disease. They're a nationwide patient organization. They just built a hospital at Gardermoen that serves the whole country. Now, just in the fall, they won a tender, basically. It's an anbud through Helse Sør-Øst, which is this region of Norway. So it's kind of a self-governing organization that takes care of all the clinical services in this part of Norway, specialized healthcare, but mandated by the government, I should say. Now, normally, they will buy some services from private providers. They buy a lot of services from LOL, especially when it comes to rehabilitation and so on. And they will often buy services when they kind of need to take the cap off a need. So if the wait times are very long at the public hospitals and so on. And that's the case for people with sleep apnea. So therefore, LOL won this bid, and they now have the right or the opportunity to execute 2,100 assessments per year, which should result in approximately 900 treatments. So these are limitations to how many people they can assess and treat at LOL. So I said sleep apnea. You probably want to know what is sleep apnea. Specifically, we're talking about obstructive sleep apnea. So there's another kind that's more, it's called central sleep apnea. That's more neurologically related. But obstructive sleep apnea is actually more of a mechanical issue. So when you sleep, your muscles relax. And there's very good reasons for that. If your muscles were activated during sleep, you would act out all your dreams. And that could obviously cause some physical damage to yourself and others. And it still does happen, of course, if you have sleepwalking and so on. In some cases, this causes the tongue to fall back, actually obstructing your airways. Your upper airways will be completely obstructed. And this happens to most people. Most people actually have some of these short or longer apneas, they're called. Basically, you stop breathing a few times every hour. It's not that uncommon. What causes or makes it sleep apnea is when these become very frequent and or very long. So there's a combination of factors. It's also dependent a little bit on your daytime symptoms. So there's a bit of a, it's not a hard line definition on what the diagnosis is, but generally anything over 5 of these per hour is considered sleep apnea. And the more severe and more frequent, and also the more severe daytime symptom is, the more need you have for treatment. Usually your daytime symptoms are drowsiness, fatigue, and so on. I'm sure you all know what it feels like when you haven't slept much at all. The more under-communicated, perhaps, risks with sleep apnea, which is coming more and more into, I think more and more people are recognizing and acknowledging, there's also a lot more evidence for this, is that it increases your risk of cardiovascular disease, heart failure, and so on, diabetes. Recently, there's a large cohort study published from Denmark where they followed people for a long time, and effective treatment of sleep apnea significantly decreases your risk of cardiovascular events. Now, in Norway, there's estimated to be about 16% of the population have sleep apnea. Now, the severity is a bit different. That's a pretty large number. But only about 15% of those are diagnosed. Now, why is it that so many people might have this disease and they don't have a diagnosis? Well, it's something that happens during sleep, so you might not yourself be aware that you have this. it's very often that it's a partner or a family member that's the first one to say, why do you stop breathing while you're sleeping? Because what happens, it goes completely quiet and then followed by some sort of loud gasp. Some cases you wake yourself up from one of these, but you might not be aware that it's actually a condition that can be treated. And you might not suffer from very severe daytime symptoms either. You have people with very severe sleep apnea that don't feel tired during the day. Now, the gold standard treatment for sleep apnea is something called a CPAP. It's a continuous positive airway pressure, so it's an actual mask. You might have seen it. And it ensures that your airway stays open, don't collapse. It's kind of forced air. And that's the gold standard treatment for a number of reasons, which I'll get back to. And that's the treatment that they can provide at the hospital where I'm conducting this research. And just to get a bit more dramatic, we can just go to the Americans and look at some of the numbers they put out. Everything's in billions in the United States, which is very impressive. But it does talk a little bit about some of the comorbidities and, of course, some of the potentials for accidents. So typically falling behind the steering wheel, falling asleep behind the steering wheel and getting into a serious accident and so on. So I'm sure if you know anyone who's a professional driver, they're very aware of what sleep apnea is and how important it is to have it treated. In Norway, the rule is that if you have a diagnosis of sleep apnea, you have to get assessed every year by your doctor and you have to be in continuous treatment. If you're a professional, if you're an average person, you still have to get your driver's license renewed. You have to go to the doctor every third year, and you have to show that you're on effective treatment. And an even more interesting side of this probably, which is, again, it's fascinating how little we know about sleep, given that we do it so much. It's such a big part of our life. We know we sleep. And we know how we sleep a lot, but we don't really know that much about why we sleep. And I think, you know, a lot of us treat sleep as it's a very inconvenient thing that just steals our time from doing important businesses. And it's evolutionary, it seems like a disadvantage to fall asleep for large periods of time. Leaves you very vulnerable. But now research in latest years have seen like what happens in the brain and what goes on during sleep that might explain why we have to sleep. And there is a number of things that they find, of course. One of the fascinating ones, and I borrowed this illustration from Catherine Streeter at NPR. They had an interesting podcast on this. So the brain cells actually, during sleep, your brain cells kind of move farther apart. So it's almost like your brain kind of shrinks a little bit. I'm probably not using the right terms. Allowing the cerebral spinal fluid to kind of flush through your brain. And they call this brainwashing. So it's really cleaning your brain, cleaning it for some of the buildup that you have during the day. And it's not a far-fetched kind of idea that to assume that this is associated with some of the neurological conditions that might develop later in life if you don't undergo this process regularly and properly, such as Alzheimer's, dementia. Sometimes we refer to these diseases as dirty brains because of the plaque buildup and so on in the brain. So it's a very important biological process. I mentioned that CPAP therapy is the gold standard therapy. That's the machine you see there. There are alternative treatments. One of them is like a dental wafer that just forces your jaw forward to keep your airway open. So in some cases, it might be personal preference. It might be that it's mainly anatomical reasons that makes your tongue fall backwards. So if all it needs is a advancement of the jaw, you can use one of these. Surgery is probably one of the most invasive ones. Also an option for kind of the same reasons. Losing weight is an option. So some people can just lose weight and thereby negate some of the apneas. And if the only reason you're having apnea is, or the only time you're having apnea is when you're sleeping on your back, and you can reduce the severity a lot by just sleeping on your side, you can opt for the tennis ball treatments, which is literally a t-shirt or some form, but put tennis balls on your back and you'll sleep on your side. Now, you'll also wake up every time you turn on your back, so I'm not sure it's an excellent treatment, because part of the problem with sleep apnea is that you wake up a lot during sleep and therefore don't get a lot of sleep. We have a more modern version of this, which is a more advanced, I guess, version of the tennis ball on your back that also kind of trains you to sleep in a better position. The intent of this one is that over time you actually adapt your sleep behavior, so you stop sleeping on your back. So there are alternative treatments. Now, what happens in Norway is that when you have a clinical service, the types of treatment that they can provide is limited a little bit by the types of tenders and agreements, as also, of course, the evidence. So at LOL, the only treatment that they can provide is the CPAP therapy. And again, the reason is the gold standard. It's the most effective, has the most evidence, and it also ensures that you don't have apneas no matter what position you sleep in. But you could argue maybe it's a bit intrusive. I'm not sure. Although they look very happy. So. She's happy because he's not snoring, that's why. So back to the hospital and the clinical service there. So what I've done now in the initial part of the research project is really just been an observant. I've spent time there. I've been in the clinical setting. I've been in the consultation room to get the insight, to understand the context of the people that work there and the kind of patients they see. And being a non-clinical person, not a sleep expert, a designer, this is a very crucial step to kind of know what you're working with and who you're working with. So they have a team consisting of six people. It's three nurses divided kind of on two positions and two doctors. So this is what's also fascinating, is that it's a bit of a tricky schedule of people coming and going, 40% positions, 20% positions, and so on. So it's a complex system. I talked a little bit about the technology, but the approach to this project is looking at the service as a whole and not just seeing these types of solutions in isolation. Now, what is service design? The central aspect is to actually look at the holistic, so really not going straight to a solution. It doesn't mean that a solution can't be a better CPAP machine, but you can't start there, even though it might be tempting sometimes. Another important aspect is to involve all the stakeholders. To ensure competence, quality, commitment, as well as ownership to the changes, services, and processes that you might be trying to influence. You have to work with the entire user journey. So if we just use this kind of clinical journey of maybe coming to LOL, visiting the hospital, seeing the doctor, getting information, rescheduling back for an appointment, getting the machine, going home, and living with this for the rest of your life. So you can't ignore any of those parts. You have to consider it all. Think about what happens before and think about what happens after. And of course, designers, we visualize. We visualize complex information. So throughout this presentation, that's been a focus. That's also a focus in communicating with clinicians, users, and so on. And then, of course, testing, working exploratory, and making prototypes. So you do this in iterative ways before you actually go on to potentially validating and testing solutions. We're going to talk a little bit more specifically about what happens during. So again, this is what I've been doing up until now, is mapping out the service to understand what happens during, but also a little bit about what happens before and after. This is a typical process. When you get referred, patients get referred from their private fastlege, GP, thank you. Not PG, but GP, thank you. The referral is assessed by the hospital. You have preparations for assessments. You get a letter from the hospital, for example. You come in, you get assessed, you get a diagnosis, start with treatment, there's follow-up period for 1 year, and then it ends, at least the part that the hospital can control. Now, I said you have to consider what happens before and you have to consider what happens after as well. Now, this is another very fascinating thing for me learning about the system is like, how do patients actually get information? How do they get into the hospital? I said they get referred from their GP, but if the GP doesn't know where to refer you, you don't know if you're getting referred to the place that has the shortest waiting times, the best treatment, and so on. It's very much about their awareness or your awareness. So you can go find that information on your own. We have helsenorge.no, which is the online portal that will provide this information for you. And you can look up wait times and locations to actually yourself go and find where you want to get treated. And this is also anything that's on public, so it basically means you don't pay to go, right? Not private. Couple of issues is that you have to know the difference between polygraphy and polysomnography. So there's some terminology there that makes that a little bit challenging. So whoever put that portal on designed it in a user-friendly way, but didn't necessarily consider the language. So you have to have a certain level of health literacy to be able to understand what you're looking for. So these are just some observations. A lot of it is actually pushed through social media. So LOL, even though they're working actually as a provider for a public healthcare system, have to do their own marketing of the service, which to me is another paradox in a public healthcare system. They have to do their own marketing through social media to push this awareness out to both patients as well as clinicians and doctors. And of course, word of mouth, which is probably the most effective way of getting the word out. Or, like I said, you go through your GP. Unfortunately, GPs have what they refer to as referral habits. They kind of go through their own mental catalog of places that they know they can refer to based on the diagnosis that you have. They also have a system that's called DIPS Communicator, where they actually have the options of referring hospitals. However, to get on that list, the hospital, LOL, has to themselves ensure that they get into that system. There's no one who owns that system and ensures that it's updated and correct, meaning new hospitals might not be on it or new clinics might not be on it. Old ones might not be removed. So it's not necessarily the most reliable system. So again, probably the best method is word of mouth. This is looking at the clinical service during. So this is another kind of way of exercising and understanding how the clinical service works and communicating that with others and mapping it out. I'm not going to go into all of this because it might be a bit boring for most of you. But you basically have a day one of consultation. The patient goes home with equipment, so it's a polygraphy equipment that reads different parameters to assess whether or not you have sleep apnea. So it can actually read whether you're sleeping on your back, if you have apneas, your oxygen levels, and so on. Based on that, they can set the diagnosis. And of course, I'm interested in the ones who actually get diagnosed and then continue on with CPAP treatment. Once you have the diagnosis, you get a CPAP machine fitted at the hospital, and then you get it sent to you at home. And then you start your life as a person with sleep apnea, and you have to use this equipment. Now, what they've started doing at LOL is they've employed a kind of a database system, so they can actually, it's a cloud-based system, so they can actually follow you in your treatment. So it's called, I guess you'd refer to it as remote monitoring, to see how you're doing. They can actually see if you're using the equipment properly, effectively, whether you're still having apneas, and so on, whether you used it or not. And that's their way of avoiding having to bring patients back into the hospital for follow-up. So they can actually do this virtually and remotely. And they do this typically at week 4, week 12, and then they have a one-year follow-up, which actually involves a person one-on-one consultation. So this is the follow-up period. Unfortunately, through the system, so they have, it's a public, it's a private provider, so they're on a tender agreement with Helse Sør-Øst. They don't have an option to follow these patients up after 1 year, meaning they go back into the public system. So this is just a closer view of how that follow-up can work. And this is actually a very unprescribed part of the process. So the clinicians kind of do this a bit ad hoc, a little bit based on what the patient needs, what they read off the data, whether they think it's necessary to call, and so on. And of course, the patients also have the option to call them back if they have questions or issues. What's interesting is that both the patients and the clinicians do have access to the same data. Whether or not the patients actually use it and look at it, that's voluntary, of course, but they do. So they can monitor themselves as well and monitor their own sleep. Sometimes they just call. Sometimes they write a report. It's really a little bit, like I said, a little bit ad hoc, a little bit based on what they think the patient needs. After 1 year, the patient is kind of back, I kind of call it back into the system. So if they at that point have any issues with equipment, with their treatments, they're referred back to the GP, who then has to refer them to a larger public hospital. So LOL does not have the option of seeing patients that they've treated after the fact. They can only accept patients for assessment and diagnosis. And that's it. And that's a bit unfortunate. Because if you've seen a doctor, you've developed a relationship with that clinic, you've gone there for consultations, and you've experienced problem after that, it's unfortunate that you can't come back to that same provider. And I think that's a paradox and a limitation with how the system works, that it's not necessarily something I can do anything about, but I can certainly point it out and call it an issue. Like I said, you have a system, it's called AirView. This is usually what the clinicians see. So they get a list of all of the patients that's currently under therapy, and this is what the patient sees. So this is their individual output. So they can actually monitor themselves as well. It's useful for the clinicians because the software actually categorizes patients into action groups. So they can actually see, okay, this group of patients need an action because their oxygen levels are consistently too low. They're not using their masks properly. There's a lot of leakage and so on. So they can actually, the more patients they have, the easier there will be to actually understand where they have to take action and where they don't. So they can more or less customize their service or their follow-up service to the patient needs. And just a little bit of a kind of an analogy based on observation, but what it also allows you is that they have shared understanding. So they have access to the same information. So this is just a scenario where a person had started their therapy, but they were experiencing problems. This is not their data. This is just a random screenshot. Came into the clinic, and they sat around. This is a patient, the nurse, and the treating doctor discussing the findings and all the information on one screen. And this potentially then, of course, provides a platform for shared understanding, right, which is not a traditional, typical thing you find in a healthcare context necessarily. Perhaps better comfort, perhaps better communication, and certainly potentially a better tool for shared decision making on what to do and how to kind of move from here. I was in the room together with a master's student from France, actually. She was also following me that day. And to her, this was shocking because in France, you'll never have patients, doctors, nurses kind of all huddled around like a group of friends. There's a much more established authority in that system. And I think we know that authority from the Norwegian system and Scandinavian system too, but maybe it has been watered down a little bit in more recent times. So to her, that was very telling of the difference between Scandinavian healthcare maybe and French. And just to kind of back up some of those thoughts, this is all in Norwegian. I'm sorry about that, but we just had a report. This is a long, ongoing initiative trying to implement remote follow-up in primary care, I'd say, home care, for people with chronic diseases. So these are generally people with higher risks of worsening or that have to get readmitted for hospitals, but anyways, it's someone who needs consistent health service at home. And the experiences so far have been that the users feel increased follow-up. increased safety and control over their own health, and that their health is significantly improved with this type of remote follow-up. They say the dialogue with the healthcare workers is better, that they have an increased understanding of their own health situation and condition. And it also shows that you have both an increase and a decrease in the use of health services, which could suggest that the ones who need it more access it more, and the ones who need it less don't just get those default consultations that they might not need. So you kind of have a more efficient use of the healthcare service, potentially. After all of this work that they've done on implementing this and testing these and rolling these initiatives out, they also have some advice on how you should do this if you're going to do this in the future. And one of the very important things here is that you have to use the users as well as your GPs, hospitals, and clinicians, and so on in the initiative and in planning it. You have to do a lot of thorough work when it comes to gaining insight. You have to set goals for including patients, and you have to visualize, it says. So a lot of these things really kind of reflect the ideas of a service design approach to developing healthcare services. So these are just kind of promising indications that do enforce some of the concepts that I've tried to present here today. So really at the current state, I think the focus is on this part of the treatment pathway. After all, it's a lifelong disease. The follow-up part is very central. And looking at how we can maybe manage that pathway to influence user experience and perhaps in the long run, see if it has any impact on compliance. Because the reality is that a lot of people don't like their CPAP mask and don't want to use it. And you therefore have very low levels of compliance, depending on how you measure it. So that's really where I'm at currently in this research project. And I think I've mentioned a lot of these main observations. And there's also some topics for discussions that, if we don't have time today, you can take them with you. LOL is a user organization. The user focus is already there. It's integral to how they work. They have a co-working attitude already, I find, between both staff as well as between staff and users and so on. Again, this has been looking at it from a very kind of observational, systematic service point of view. I haven't yet engaged with users directly through interviews or anything, but some of the paradoxes and some of the observations so far is that you have a lot of barriers and limitations and inefficiencies in how the system is constructed, and that's specifically related to the tender system. So this being a private hospital operating on a contract from the public and kind of the limitations that come with. They cannot refer directly to any alternative treatment. So if they have a patient that's in kind of that realm that doesn't want CPAP therapy, maybe the sleep apnea is not that severe, they would like an optional treatment that you can access in Norway. The hospital does not have the option to refer you. So you have to go back to specialist healthcare where wait times can be as much as 40 weeks to get a new referral, to get a dental wafer or whatever it may be. They cannot follow patients up after 1 year, which, considering that it's a lifelong condition, potentially, that's a very short follow-up period. There are no mutual obligations with kind of the contract issuer. So Helse Sør-Øst, who's issuing this contract, doesn't seem to have a lot of mutual obligations on their end, in the sense that they don't have to ensure that you get into the GP referral system. They don't have to do any of the marketing. Everything has to get pushed from the LOL side. And in the end, these inefficiencies and issues hurt the users, because it's the users that then have to get referred back into public health, have to wait longer, and so on. And I think for as long as we have a system where public buys services from the private and we're dependent on that to treat patients faster and better, this probably has to get improved. Again, a lot of the issues that I raised today and questions are, who is the designer in design and health? Is it a professionalized representative expert patient, or is it kind of that grassroots patient that walks into the clinic? What is user involvement? And can we and how do we recruit engaged patients as kind of co-researchers in a research context? So, what's next? If I'm going to kind of position myself in this diagram, I'm still in the empathize phase here, obviously. So I looked at the system, I looked at the service quite objectively. Now I'm ready to go actually talk to the users. That includes both patients as well as clinicians and nurses and so on. Before we can actually really articulate what the main challenges are. So I've articulated some that I've observed, but those might be very different from what they experience. So I'll see you guys in a few years, maybe. That's it. I'll end with this. It's a painting by Salvador Dali, and it's called Sleep, and I think it's a nice illustration of how fragile sleep is, and I hope you all go home and go to bed early and read a good book and don't look at your phones, because after empathizing with people with sleep apnea, you really appreciate having a normal good night's sleep. Think about your brains. Yeah. Thank you.